Joe Dante made his first film on a bet with Roger Corman, the king of B-movies. Dante bet that he and his partner Alan Arkush could make a movie cheaper than any Corman had ever made before. The result was Hollywood Boulevard, shot in 10 days for $60,000. It won the bet for the young filmmakers. Joe Dante learned how to make movies working for Roger Corman's film factory, New World Pictures. There's no doubt that Dante knows how to make movies on a super low budget, but nowadays he doesn't have to. He's the director of The Howling, Gremlins, Inner Space, and the It's a Good Life segment of Twilight Zone the movie. His new film is a comedy starring Tom Hanks called The Burbs. Hanks plays a suburban father and husband who decides to spend his vacation at home with the family. But he gets preoccupied with paranoid fantasies about his new mysterious next-door neighbors. Their house is in such disrepair it looks haunted. Every night the quiet is shattered by a loud machine-like noise coming out of the house. But nobody ever sees these residents because they never leave home. But one day, Hanks and his friend spot one of the mysterious neighbors on his porch. Hanks' friend thinks it's time to investigate.
Well, why don't you go say hi?
Well, yeah, I guess I could.
You know, this would be the perfect time because you could go up and talk to him. We could see what he's like, you know. Go.
You could go say hi to him, too, you know.
Yeah, but he's your neighbor.
Well, no, he's your neighbor as well.
No, but I'm over. You share a property line with him. He's
yeah,
your,
but
like,
we're all on the same block, so, I mean, you could go, too. So.
No, we're all in the same town, too, but you're right next to him. If he was ever going to borrow anything, he'd come over to your place.
Well, he's busy now.
He's not busy. Now, look, he's going into... Go now, because if... I mean, he's going back in. If you were going to say hi, you should probably... There, he's going into the... You're going to lose him, because he's going to go in... Well, there, now you've blown it, haven't you?
No, I didn't blow it. He went into his house.
Chicken.
Joe Dante, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you, Tori.
Did you grow up in the suburbs yourself?
I did grow up in the suburbs, and oddly enough, it was a suburb kind of like the one in the movie.
Was there a weird family on the block?
There seems to be a weird family in every suburb. While we were making the picture, a lot of people came up to me and said, you know, this is the strangest thing, but when I was a kid, we had a weird house on our block where people never came out, and the newspapers piled up in front of the door, and everybody wondered what they were up to.
You know, in apartment buildings, there's a weird family on every floor.
Well, let's face it, there's a lot of weird people out there.
So what was your weird family like?
My weird family was, they were kind of strange people that worked in at night, and they never came out in the daytime. And there were a whole litany of strange stories that people made up about them, and I have no idea whether any of them were true or not.
I think The Burbs is one of several recent films that are about horrible things happening in the middle of the wholesome suburbs. And I wonder why you think that's become such a compelling image to people.
Well, I think maybe because the suburbs have, you know, for so long been considered the bastion of sanctity that people move to get out of the city with its evil ways. But after a while, you know, only so many people can move into the suburbs before you start getting the same mix of people that you had in the city. when we were making this picture, during the production, there was a story about some people who moved into a house in Pasadena and found body bags full of body parts in the house. And it turned out that it apparently had belonged to a pathologist or something, and they had forgotten to bring all their specimens with them. But it was a little bit creepily like what we were doing.
Did you want to cast Tom Hanks in the leading role? Was that your choice? I mean, was that your idea?
Was it my idea? I don't know that it was my idea, but it was a good idea.
No, you directed him shortly before he became quite the star that he is today, because I assume this was shot right before Big and Punchline came out.
It was. Tom had made Punchline, and that was sort of in editing, and then he made Big, and Big was released while we were making the picture, as was Punchline. And the funny thing is that although his star stature increased immeasurably during the making of the movie, his behavior never changed. Mm-hmm. He is still very unassuming and really a non-showbiz kind of guy.
Dick Miller has a cameo in your new film, as he does in every one of your movies. In the new film, he drives a garbage truck, or he's a sanitation man.
Sanitation engineer.
And yeah, I think he's best known for his roles in Little Shop of Horror and Bucket of Blood. How come you use him in all of your movies?
Boy, this is really an esoteric program. I used Dick in my first picture. I had grown up seeing Dick in the movies. He'd been in a lot of Roger Corman movies that I saw when I was in college. And I wanted to have him in my first picture because I just thought it would be nice. And he was very good in it. And ever since then, we became friends. And whenever I do a picture, one of the things that I look for in a script, which is pretty silly, but I always wonder, well, now I wonder what part Dick can play. And in this movie, this was the part. It's alas, only a garbage man, but he does the most he can with it.
There are always little in-jokes in your movies and usually a lot of film references, film jokes in them. And I was wondering if you ever thought that you'd end up actually making comedies like The Burbs and like Inner Space.
Well, when I started, actually my first picture was a comedy, and a good thing, too, because of the kind of movie that it was, they would have laughed at it anyway. But I sort of got typed into doing horror pictures. But if you go back and look at them, they're really more comedies than horror pictures. I don't think I've ever really done a quote, serious picture.
Well, The Howling, which is one of your horror films, is about a coven of modern-day werewolves that basically have all this... New Age consciousness, self-help kind of stuff that they do.
It's an Estean werewolf picture.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And every time one of the guys in the movie gets a phone call about another werewolf hit, there's always a werewolf movie or a werewolf cartoon on television in the background.
Well, that was because all the previous werewolf movies had this obligatory scene where the characters would say, so tell me, Doctor, what is a werewolf? And then they would have to explain it. And movie audiences like already knew what werewolves were, thank you very much. And I thought it was time to make a movie about people who are just like us, who know about werewolves from movies and TV. And so when one comes up in their life, they cut right to the chase. They know already what it is.
Sure, he's watching the film that says, whenever a man gets bitten by a werewolf, he becomes a werewolf himself. What movie was that from?
Well, that's from The Wolfman. And the reason we did that was because it's really the classic werewolf picture. And there's the poem that they have in it about even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright is like, you know, it's pure poetry, let's face it, and we couldn't top it.
How much does it cost to take just 30 seconds of film like that and use it in one of your movies?
It varies. Actually, there's been a sort of a moratorium on doing that. There are a lot of actor agreements that were negotiated whereby pictures from pre-1948 or 1960 you don't have to pay residuals to. But recently, I think MCA used a scene of Janet Leigh in Psycho, and they used it in Psycho 2 without asking her, and she sued them. And now I believe the policy is that you have to get permission from either the actors or their estates to be able to use any clip.
Mm. My guest is Joe Dante, and his new film is called The Burbs, and it stars Tom Hanks. His other films include Gremlins, The Howling, Piranha, Inner Space, and a segment of Twilight Zone, the movie. As you've said, you know, you've done a lot of horror films. Did you like a lot of horror films when you were growing up?
Yeah, I did. I liked horror films and science fiction films and westerns and crime movies and, you know, movies that are now have this fancy word genre attached to them. But are really just old-fashioned formula story pictures. And I was very pleased to get to make those kind of movies. Those are the kind of movies I like the most.
You know, I've recently seen some monster movies on television, and I'm always shocked by how really dull they are. I loved these films as a kid. And when I look back at them, the monster's on screen for around 2 minutes, and the rest of it is a lot of scientists gabbing about how to kill the monster.
Well, it depends on the movie. I mean, the Thing still holds up, and that's a picture where the monster isn't on screen all the time. The funny thing about when seeing movies when you're a kid is that some of the things that most impress you when you're a child watching movies are simply moments or scenes. And when you get a little older and you start to look at these pictures again, you start to realize that around that scene was a probably pretty uninspired movie.
Were there any scenes that terrified you when you were young, that gave you bad dreams?
I was partial to being scared of giant insects. And I happened to grow up in the post-atomic boom period where all of the metaphorical anti-nuclear movies were done in the form of giant insects, sort of symbols of atomic destruction. And Them, which is a picture about giant ants in the storm drains of Los Angeles, was a particularly scary movie because they had these crickety kind of sounds that they made, which were just like the sounds that were coming out of my backyard at the time. And there was a giant spider movie called Tarantula that was very upsetting. I remember I begged my father to take me to see this picture, and because it was only playing on Wednesday and Thursday, and I wouldn't be able to go on Saturday afternoon. And I managed to talk him into going, even though he was real tired. And then he was really mad at me because I was so scared that I spent most of the movie pacing in the lobby.
Obviously, you liked being scared.
Apparently.
Now, you wanted to be a cartoonist when you were young, right?
Yeah, I originally started out wanting to be a cartoonist. And I would get up in the morning, like at 5 in the morning, and draw cartoons before I went to school and stuff like that. And little did I realize that I was sort of rehearsing for being a movie director, because it's cartoons and movies, particularly mine, are kind of similar. I mean, when you do storyboards for movies, they look just like comic strips.
You got your start working with Roger Corman. How did you get the job?
I was one of those lucky guys who, during a very prolific period of Roger's producing career, I was one of a number of people who was lucky enough to get in on the bottom, and which is the best place to start. A friend of mine named John Davison, who since has gone on to produce RoboCop and Airplane, was working for Roger in the publicity department, and he invited me to come from Philadelphia, where I was living at the time, to Hollywood and do trailers for New World Pictures, which was a company Roger owned at the time. And they specialized in pictures with busty young nurses and a lot of Filipino horror pictures and stuff like that. And it was a very educational job. I learned a lot by doing trailers, because in order to do it, you have to watch a movie over and over, and you have to pull out the pieces you think are going to be appealing to people, and then you have to edit them down into some sort of coherent 2-minute film. And in doing it, you look at all the mistakes that the director made making the movie and all the things he did right, and you start to realize how plastic and elastic the movie medium can be. And when you're not working with somebody else's footage, believe me, you're somewhat more, we have more wild abandon in the way you want to cut it than when it's something that you've actually shot yourself.
Did you write the copy for these trailers?
We used to do the copy. My friend Alan Arkish and I were the heads of the trailer department, such as we were, both of us, two of us. And we used to have used to do copy, like we had a picture called TNT Jackson, which was a black exploitation picture about a martial arts lady. And we had lines like, TNT Jackson, she'll put you in traction. This black lady's charms will break both your arms. With her dynamite bod, she's a jet black hit squad. Stuff like that. That was around the time that Muhammad Ali was doing all that stuff. So, little dated now.
Can a good trailer sell a bad film?
A good trailer can sell a bad film for a weekend, but if the film isn't good, people will find out and they will tell their friends not to go. However, a bad trailer can really kill a good film.
Now, I think what you used to do when you were doing trailers for Corman was to find whatever action sequence there was or whatever nude sequence there was and highlight that or string those moments together.
Well, sometimes... Sometimes the movies... to put it charitably, we're not first-class pictures. And sometimes they had very little in the way of action at all. And so we actually had this exploding helicopter shot that we got out of one movie that was really pretty good. And whenever the trailer got really dull, we would always cut to the exploding helicopter, whether it was in the movie or not.
Are you happy with the trailers that have been done for your movies?
It's real hard to say, because I did the trailer for my own first picture, and I remember saying to myself, how could this be so hard with this movie when it was so easy with all the other ones? When you do your own movie, there's certain things you don't want to give away. You don't want to give away the ending. You don't want to give away this great joke. You want to give away something. And when other people, of course, get a hold of your trailer, your picture, and make a trailer out of it, they want to use all the good stuff, just like you did when you made trailers. And so it becomes kind of hard to criticize them, even when they're giving away things that you feel maybe are the things that they shouldn't put in.
You've said that Roger Corman's studios weren't a director studio, they weren't a producer studio, it was really an editor studio. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I meant was that because the films were made so quickly and because the material was so exploitative, that the actual making of the film was just an act of hysteria. The only time that you really had a chance to reflect, and this is true of all movies, really reflect on what you've done is when you actually have it in front of you. And the secret of making a successful New World picture was not in what you showed, but what you didn't show. Because most of the people who were working there were people who were making their first or second picture, and you make a lot of mistakes, and there's a lot of sort of things that you do where you say, well, golly, I what a great crane shot this is. It's the first time I ever did a crane shot. This is a great crane shot. And you put it in the movie, and guess what? It's really dull. I mean, it's not a very interesting thing. It's a crane shot, period. And you have to be able to say, okay, I'm going to take that out, because that doesn't help the picture. And what you really learned at Corman's was how to speed up a movie and how to make it happen fast and make the bad parts go away fast so that you could concentrate on the good parts.
Are those skills you've been able to use in your recent movies? Have you been able to edit them yourself or supervise the editing?
Well, the studios really look down on people editing and directing. They feel that that is, you know, it's bad enough that we have to hire these people, but now we give them control, like letting them direct and edit, forget it. So they sort of frown on it. However, you pick an editor that you're sympathetic with, and you go in there and you sort of, you know, work it out and listen to their ideas, and you have your own. And it's my favorite part of filmmaking, actually. I think it's the most challenging part, because you actually have a chance to really think and reconceptualize things that maybe didn't work the first time.
Have you ever felt that the intention of a scene was really undermined because of the way it was edited?
Not in any films that I've done, only because I've been lucky enough to work for people. First Roger, who was a one-man studio, and then Steven Spielberg, who has basic control over the movies that he produces, who are filmmakers. And so I've never had a picture come out that was not edited the way I wanted, except a picture called Explorers, which was not edited the way I wanted. It just wasn't finished.
You've gotten to work with really cheap and really state-of-the-art special effects. For instance, in the real cheap category, in one of your early films, Piranha, which was, I think it's fair to say, trying to cash in on the success of Jaws.
I think that's fair to say.
you worked with rubber fish.
Yes, rubber fish. Well, I've worked with the best of them. And actually, the rubber fish were designed by people who later that year went on to do Star Wars. And it was like a maiden effort of a lot of people who then became very famous. And considering the budget, the effects are actually pretty good.
And then just a few years later, several years later, you made Gremlins, which was a Steven Spielberg-produced movie. And there were whole scenes where you were directing little...
puppets, let's face
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right, thank you. Didn't know exactly what to call them. But these little, like, monster puppets. It must be a kind of strange role for a director to have when, I don't know, who directs it, the director or the special effects person in a scene like that?
Well, the director has to direct it. The effects person has to make it work, but the director has to tell them what to do and, you know, what angle we're going to shoot at and what I want them to do. And it's basically, it's one of the most frustrating things imaginable, because almost never can they do what it is that you really want them to do, because after all, they are only puppets, and your job is to try to make them look real. So you have to experiment with different camera speeds and different kinds of lighting. And in the making of Gremlins, which took 2 years from the time that I read it to the time it came out, we really learned as we went, and the movie changed considerably while we were shooting, simply because of the abilities that we started to be able to figure out about how the puppets were working and what we could make them do, and that they looked better when we put clothes on them, and that they were funny when they did this and not funny when they did that. And so we kind of made up a lot of Gremlins as we went along.
Is it enjoyable to have scenes like that with puppets, or do you find it a frustration to have to spend so much time getting the effects right?
Well, if you have a good sense of the absurd, which I do, it's pretty entertaining to sit there and imagine that people are paying you money to make this puppet pick its nose. But the fun actually is in trying to make it real and trying to put it all together with the right sound effects and everything and make something that couldn't possibly happen look like it's actually happening.
Now, how would you have done a movie like Gremlins if you were making it really on the cheap for Roger Corman? What kind of place would you have cut corners?
Well, the thing about Gremlins, which was that it started out to be a cheap movie, or else, believe me, Spielberg wouldn't have called me. We were going to make the picture non-union, and we were going to make it in Oregon. And it was going to be a cheap, low-budget, non-union horror picture. And we realized that it was impossible to do most of the things that were written in the script unless we had somewhat more of an ability to spend money. And there were a couple of Gremlin ripoffs that came out. One of them was called Ghoulies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the way the picture would have been made if it had been made for Roger. Basically, they had some puppets that didn't do very much, and you couldn't be on the screen for very long. The secret I think part of the secret of the success of Gremlins is that the puppets were interesting enough and articulated enough to be able to withstand scrutiny. And on a cheap film, one of the things that you have to do is keep inventing reasons and ways not to show what you can't do well.
Do you think that you and Spielberg share the same sense of horror?
Stephen is not a very dark guy. He's Mr. E.T. I mean, he really is a bright, optimistic kind of a guy, and I don't think that dark side comes that easily to him. I think one of the interesting things about Gremlins was the mix of what I do and my sensibility with his. People have said that the first half of the movie looks like Spielberg did it and the second half of the movie looks like I did it. But the idea, actually, originally it was all a horror movie, and we added the sort of the warmth and the humor part just to sort of lighten it up.
Inner Space was the first big hit comedy that you did. I think that's fair to say, right?
Well, no, it's not actually fair to say.
Okay.
Because it wasn't a big hit. It was a big
hit
overseas.
Wasn't a big hit? Oh.
It was a big hit overseas, but it wasn't a big hit here.
Oh, I thought it was.
But it was a big comedy. Was that? It just, you have to leave the hit part out.
Okay. Did you enjoy working with an actor like Martin Short? And I guess I'm wondering, when there's that wonderful scene when he gets, he's at the doctor and he gets injected, and actually what he's getting injected with is Dennis Quaid's micro-sized body, and he realizes he's possessed. What was shooting that scene like?
Well, interestingly, that scene was shot twice. We shot it once with Marty and two extras in the room with him as the doctor patients, and we just weren't happy with it. It just didn't seem to be quite right, and then Marty suggested that we get Joe Flaherty and Andrea Martin, with whom he had worked quite well on SCTV, just to be the other people and for him to work off of. And we reshot the scene, and it was hilarious, and the difference was palpable. And it's funny, because when you look at the scene, you don't really think that the other people are doing much. But when you see it with the other extras who really weren't doing much, you see what supporting people can do for an actor in a scene.
That's really interesting. You know, when I saw the movie, I was really wondering why they had such small parts, but I guess that explains why they were there in the first place.
That was it.
Do you ever see your former colleagues from the Roger Corman days?
Oh, sure. Yes, it's a very special fraternity of people, and I say fraternity. That's actually not. It's also a sorority of people who, at a very formative moment in their lives, all happened to be in the same place at the same time, and I sadly note that although Roger is still making pictures and there is still, I think, an influx of people who are getting a chance from him, that it's slowed down to a trickle because of the rising costs of movies. He was much more likely to want to risk $60,000 on somebody who hadn't made a picture than he is now with $500,000 or $1 million, which is what it costs to make a picture now.
You've done really cheap movies. You've done more expensive movies. Are you really very aware of ways that expensive movies sometimes waste money? And does that upset you when you come across that in a film?
It's not so much the waste of money as the fact that the attitude is different when you make a big film. I in between making all these big pictures, I went back and made a shot some segments of a comedy picture that no one has ever seen called Amazon Woman on the Moon. And it was a non-union picture, and it was very, you know, sort of let's put on a show, sort of like the Corman days. And it was very charming to do that again, because when you do a low-budget picture, there's a lot less feeling that you have to make a movie that's so homogenized that everyone in the world will like it and we can make all our money back. Because when you have big sums behind you, there is a lot of feeling that the more bland this movie is, the more successful it will be, and more people will like it, and the more people will go see it. Where I happen to hold an opposite view, which is that the big movies, the big breakthrough movies, have always been pictures that were very risky, and people took chances, and movies that had a real personality of their own. And I think if there's anything that's the hardest thing to do right now in the movie business is to make a picture that has a personality, because there are a lot of people whose job it is to try to keep you from imposing your personality on the film.
How is that done exactly?
Well, basically, there's a process called development, which also is known as development hell. And what that is that you have a project, you take it to a studio, they say, yes, we'd be interested in developing this, and you hire a writer, or the writer comes in, and the studio gives you notes on how the film should progress. And I actually had the experience recently, or last year, of having a small film that I wanted to do. That I took to a studio, and we developed it for a year, And I picked it up one day and I read it and I said, you know, this is absolutely not what I want to do. This is like so far away from what I brought in here. It was, what they do is they add explanations so that people won't be confused. People explain things, then they do them, then they explain why they did them. And I finally went back and said, look, this is the first draft that I handed you a year ago. This is really what I want to make. Do you guys want to make this or not? And of course it turned out, no, they never really did want to make it. And I don't think that's an uncommon story. I think that happens a lot.
So do you sometimes take on movies that you don't really want to do, yet you want to work, so you'll take it on?
No, I've never had to do that, luckily. That's not true. I had to do that with Piranha. I didn't think Piranha was really the world's greatest idea for a picture. I said to Roger, you know, why did you wait 2 years to make a remake of Jaws and then have it come out the same year as Jaws 2? And he said, well, you know, just happened to work out that way.
Well, you know, that movie was a big hit, right?
It was a big hit, yes.
And it probably does well on video.
It does great on video, and it was very big overseas in places like Rio and Paraguay and places where people know what piranhas are.
And it's run on TV. Can you explain its success?
Who can explain the success of anything? I mean, I don't know. It's a mystery why people like certain pictures and why they don't. Sometimes it's timing. Sometimes it's the type of movie it is. Some kinds of pictures date less badly than others. But the interesting, the TV version of Piranha that is usually run on TV is shorter than most movies. And so the TV stations now have this machine that they turn it on and it makes the movie go slower by repeating frames in the middle of each shot. And if your picture is too long, they have another machine that speeds it up and makes everything happen faster. So it really, when you make a picture, you work on it for X number of months or years, and then you hone it down and you get all the details as fine-tuned as possible, and then you give it away to the people that you made it for. And after that, they can turn it into guitar picks. They can really do anything they want with it. It's quite a remarkable business.
Very remarkable.